Good evening, everyone. I might declare the meeting open. It's my pleasure to welcome everybody to this evening's meeting on Monday, the 18th of December 2023, and it is, in fact, our last meeting for the year. Welcome to the members of the community who are in the public gallery this evening, and also to those members of the community who are watching along at home on YouTube. It gives me great pleasure now to declare the meeting officially open. I wish to advise that council meetings are recorded and made publicly available on our website, and in accordance with council's policy, I would ask the general manager to confirm that the audio recording has started.
Confirm, Mayor.
Thank you. I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, pay respects to elders past and present, and also acknowledge today's Tasmanian Aboriginal community. Our attendees this evening are myself, Councillor Reed, the Deputy Mayor, Councillor Gladright, Councillor Antoli, Councillor Bain, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Dean, Councillor Fox, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Richardson and Councillor Street. From our staff this evening, we have the General Manager, Mr Arnold, the Chief Financial Officer, Mr Spinks, no he's not, he's the Director of People and Finance, Mr Spinks, the Director of Governance, Recreation and Property Services, Mr Smee, Director of Engineering Services, Mr Reeve, Director of Environment Development and Community Services, Ms Shikuti, Manager of Development Services, Ms Tyler Moore, our Executive Assistant, Mrs Morton, and our Communications and Engagement Support Officer, Ms Klein. We don't have any apologies this evening. We're now on page one, and the motion is that the minutes of the open session of Council Meeting Number 23, held on the 4th of December 2023, be confirmed as a true record. Looking for a mover and a seconder. I've got a mover in Councillor Fox and a seconder in Councillor Midgley. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Still on page one, workshops held since the last council meeting. We did not have any workshops since the last council meeting. Declarations of interest. Does any councillor have an interest they would like to declare? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. Item 15.1, I just wanted to flag that it's managing conflicts of interest of councillors, and I just thought that we all have a conflict, and I just wanted to maybe seek your advice on just to acknowledge that, to air it, and then to proceed. I don't plan on stepping out of the room for it, but I just thought it's worth noting.
Thank you, General Manager. Would you like to provide some comment, please?
Through you, Mayor. Councillor Cordova, it would be an interest held in common with all councillors across the state, would be my first observation. And secondly, it's a report regarding a proposed framework which is not legislated at this point in time.
Thank you. We're now on page two, transfer of agenda items. Is there any item that a councillor would like to transfer from open into closed session or closed into open session? Councillor Midgley, were you going to make a suggestion in relation to the order of the agenda that you wanted to share? Because I'm a mind reader.
Sure, yes. I did sort of ask the movers of the people who put that motion forward, and they didn't seem to mind. So I thought, you know, we could move the AGM motions to the beginning of the meeting if the audience or the audience might like to wait for the whole meeting, but we could.
Well, in the interests of not keeping anybody here unnecessarily, although we do welcome everyone to come and stay for the whole meeting, I'm happy to accept that suggestion and move the motion in relation to environmental reports on page 37 and also the motion in relation to stakeholder engagement on page 40 to be the first two items dealt with under officers' reports to council. Is that acceptable to everybody? Yep. Thank you. Moving on now, we have questions without notice from the public. Does any... beg your pardon, we do need a mover and a seconder for that. Moved Councillor Midgley, seconded Councillor Cordova. All those in favour? Against? Carried unanimously. Now we come to questions without notice from the public. Does any member of the public here tonight have a question without notice? If so, if you'd like to come to the lectern, please, and state your name and the suburb that you're from.
Charles Biggins, Leslievale. Some further questions. Membership of the body corporate entity known as council. If the legal structure of council is that of a body corporate, and Section 19 of the Local Government Act clearly states that it is, then who are the members of that body corporate?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Mr. Biggins, the members of Council are elected at the local government elections that are held in Tasmania every 4 years. The last election was held in October 2022.
Do landholders of this municipality automatically become members of the body corporate and pay a membership fee in the form of rates to the body corporate?
The General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. The first part of your question, Mr. Biggins, the answer is no. The elected members of the council are the councillors, duly elected at a local government election. And the second part of your question, the answer is yes. Under the Local Government Act 1993, the council is empowered under legislation to charge a general rate to all ratepayers in the municipality.
Mr. Biggins, further questions?
Are we at a body corporate meeting this evening? Did we attend the body corporate AGM a couple of weeks ago?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. We're at a Canberra Council meeting this evening, Mr. Biggins, and a couple of weeks ago we attended the Canberra Council annual general meeting.
Further questions, Mr.
Biggins? At the AGM, were motions from the floor moved and seconded and voted on by the membership of that body corporate?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. The motions at the annual general meeting, Mr. Biggins, were moved by residents of the municipality and voted on by residents of the municipality.
In accordance with the Local Government Act of 1993.
Correct.
Are councillors the directors of the body corporate elected by the membership to represent the interests of the membership?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Councillors are elected by the ratepayers in the municipality that are eligible to vote at local government elections.
Is one of the primary responsibilities of the council to collectively direct the general manager? Is the general manager the only member of staff that councillors can direct?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor, the councillors are empowered under the Local Government Act to appoint a general manager. And the General Manager has certain functions under the Local Government Act which include the employment of all other staff.
If I can just add to that, under Section 28, subsection 3A, it indicates in the Local Government Act that in performing any function under this Act or any other Act, a councillor must not direct or attempt to direct an employee of the council in relation to the discharge of the employee's duties. So I would take that to also include the general manager, who is an employee of the council in addition. Is there a further question?
I'd seek clarification on whether councillors collectively direct the general manager. Will the incoming general manager retain that title, or will they be referred to as the CEO of the body corporate?
So, thank you for the question, Mr. Biggins. We have recently started the recruitment process, which we are shortly finalising, and within that, we, in line with some other councils around the state, have chosen to retitle the position of General Manager to be Chief Executive Officer.
Is it still appropriate in this day and age to be referring to the membership of the body corporate as ratepayers, which implies that the payment of rates is the only body corporate function and responsibility they have?
General Manager, would you like to address that?
Through you, Mayor, I would not refer to the Council as a body corporate as you have, Mr. Biggins, and I have previously this evening answered your question about the Council's ability under the Local Government Act to set and charge a general rate for those residents of, and ratepayers of the municipality that own property within Kingborough or any other council in Tasmania.
Thank you. Got further questions relating to the Greater Hobart Bushfire Index. Is Kingborough Council aware that the Greater Hobart Bushfire Index was launched on the 13th of December by a Hobart-based business, Geo Neon?
Yes, we are. Thank you, Mr. Biggins. I was supposed to attend with the General Manager. Unfortunately, at the last minute, we had to attend to other matters, but we were represented by our Manager of Environmental Services at the launch.
Was Council aware that the project was funded by the National Emergency Management Agency and that Geo Neon partnered with several information technology companies and the University of Tasmania to produce specialised climate change adaptation software tools?
Yes, we were. We have been briefed on that, and further, some time ago, only about 6 weeks ago, as part of my role as Vice President of the Local Government Association, I had occasion to have a visit to hear from the National Emergency Management Authority, from their director, and also tour the National Situation Room. So I am fully aware of the work of that organisation and what occurs on a national level in the event of an emergency.
Kingborough Council's logo appears on the front page of the Bushfire Index. What was the scope of involvement from Kingborough Council in the federally funded project?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. We'll take that question on notice, Mr. Biggins, to provide a detailed response.
How does Council plan to use the Greater Hobart Bushfire Index that allocates a bushfire risk score to each individual property within the municipality of Glenorchy, Hobart and Kingborough?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Mr. Biggins, as you're aware, the launch only occurred a few days ago. Council officers will work through the data that's been provided, and in due course there will be a further report coming to Council to respond not only to your question but also to provide for Council's decision what options on utilisation of that software and data moving forward.
The Bushfire Index identifies 800 Kingborough properties, dwellings, to be at high to extreme risk. Is this assessment consistent with the many other bushfire reports received by Council in the last 10 years?
Thank you, Mr. Biggins. We'll take that question on notice as well. We don't have our Manager of Environmental Services with us here this evening, so in order to provide an accurate response, we will take that on notice. Thank you.
Kingborough's 800 at-risk properties make up 80% of the total high to extreme risk properties for the entire Greater Hobart Bushfire Index. Is this an acceptable level of risk for the General Manager?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Once again, Mr. Biggins, you raise some valid points about a recently launched data set that Council officers will work through over the coming weeks and months to determine the implications of that data set on properties within Kingborough.
Of the 800 at-risk properties, approximately 20 of them are at extreme risk. Will the General Manager investigate these extreme risk properties with the purpose of identifying any fire hazards on those or neighbouring properties that should be abated by Council to at least reduce the risk out of the extreme bushfire risk range.
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Once again, Mr. Biggins, the data set was only launched publicly a few days ago. Council officers are working through that data set and will continue to do so to determine the implications before reporting back to Council.
Council commissioned its own bushfire risk report from Melbourne University at the beginning of the year that identified 35 kilometres of high to extreme risk council roads and was subsequently engaged a contractor to ground truth the results of the Melbourne University report. How many reports does the General Manager need, and when does Council intend to abate its own 35 kilometres of bushfire hazard?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Mr. Biggins, we are currently working through that data set as well and the implications arising from it, and taking action as appropriate.
Over the last 10 years, has the General Manager fulfilled his duty under the Local Government Act to ensure the health, safety and environment of the municipality when at least 20 dwellings have been identified as being at extreme fire risk, and every one of those residents evacuating from a bushfire event would need to pass through at least 2 kilometres of extreme fire risk council roads?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Mr. Biggins, Council annually undertakes a range of measures to address the risk of bushfire, mindful that over 90% of Kingborough is in an area of high fire risk, and those measures include working with the Tasmanian Fire Service, community engagement sessions to prepare our community, to get the message across that everyone has a role to play in being prepared to address any risk from a potential bushfire, and we will continue to do that, and we will continue to work through the data sets and new information as it becomes available to us.
Do you have another question, Mr. Biggins?
Yes, one more. Given that property inspections, reports, abatement notices and council approvals will take months, and the actual fuel reduction works could take many months, if not years, to complete, will Council be prioritising this work in preparation for the 2024-25 bushfire season?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Mr. Biggins, as I've said a few minutes ago, the Council annually undertakes a range of mitigation measures, including with local fire brigades and the Tasmanian Fire Service, cool burns on council reserves. We have a maintenance program for roadside vegetation, and we will continue to look at every opportunity to work with our community to reduce the risk of bushfire.
The General Manager is duty-bound to abate a known fire hazard under the Local Government Act, and a council policy cannot be in conflict with an act. So the only exemption in the Kingborough Interim Planning Scheme for biodiversity offsets are for when a fire hazard has been identified in a bushfire hazard management plan or when a prescribed burn-off is approved by the TFS. Why are landholders still required to apply for council permit to remove trees within a bushfire hazard management plan when no offset is payable by the landholder?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor, Mr. Biggins, I think you are intertwining a couple of issues which are not necessarily related. Being an abatement notice that is issued where council officers have determined that a property is a fire risk is completely done in isolation to any council biodiversity offset policy or any requirement under the local LUPA, the Planning Act, insofar as an application for a development approval for a dwelling that might require removal of vegetation. The two are not related.
The exemptions that exist in the planning scheme for biodiversity offsetting, they're only there because a fire risk has been identified, and technically the general manager would need to abate that. And we've already established that if you needed to abate a hazard, the biodiversity offset is not payable. So those exemptions only exist in the planning scheme because of the Local Government Act requirement for a fire hazard to be abated, yes or no?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. The Local Government Act allows a council, through the General Manager, to abate a nuisance. LUPA, the Planning Act, allows biodiversity offsets to apply. I hope that provides the clarification you're looking for, Mr. Biggins.
The exemptions in LUPA.
Is there a further question, Mr. Biggins? I'm conscious there may be other members of the community who wish to ask questions this evening.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thank you. Is there anyone else with us this evening who would like to ask questions? Thank you. We then move on to questions on notice from the public. We have four. The first is in relation to Mr. Biggins in relation to abatement notice with a response from Ms. Quinn. The second one is from Ms. Landon with an officer's response from Ms. Tyler Moore in relation to biodiversity offset policy. The third question is from Ash Towns in relation to Kingston Park with an officer response from Mr. Smee. And the final one on page three is a question from Ms. Lyons with an officer's response from Mr. Smee in relation to the Northwest Bay Cemetery and natural burials, which takes us to page four, questions without notice from councillors. Does any councillor wish to ask a question without notice? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. And I'm pleased to hear that, we have this robust discussion about bushfire survival. I think it's really important, and I'm glad it's been raised. Timely reminder to get our bushfire survival plans, fire.tas.gov.au. My
Are
question
you an
relates to
right now?
Trying to be. My question relates to road safety, and this one is about Van Moree Road. A constituent's raised with me possible road safety issues on Van Moree Road along Van Moree Road, south of Petted Road, between poles 51 and 53, there's a corner that is apparently unsafe, and I am led to understand that bus drivers have made a complaint to council about that corner. Is there any road widening, visibility improvements, or other construction or remediation work planned for that corner south of Petted Road on Van Moree?
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor. We've done a fair bit of work on Van Moree Road over the last 2-3 years, including a number of different areas there where we've done some localised widening and benching along the road there to improve site distance. There's no immediate plans for any additional work, but happy to take that on notice and have a look at that and see whether any additional work is required and needs to be put forward for a future budget bid.
Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. So Kingborough's submission to host the AFL High Performance Centre has been gaining a lot of interest over the last few days. Firstly, can I congratulate all the staff involved who put together an excellent submission with detailed responses to every single criteria that State Growth Advice will be part of the assessment. And my question in relation to this is, have we received any feedback regarding our submission and our chances of being successful? And have we been advised when a decision will be made?
Thank you, Councillor Bain. Can I start by echoing your comments in relation to the submission that Kingborough Council put forward? I'm very grateful to the two staff members who worked on this and really developed quite a strategic approach to how we might progress this for the, in the best interests of both the local community but also for the aspirations of the new Tasmanian AFL team. I've received some feedback just from the community over the few days since we released it, from everyone from the local butcher through to people in my gym class and others who say, wouldn't it be so exciting to get the Performance Centre here in Kingborough? It's certainly got some attention in the media, and certainly the feedback from the journalists concerned seemed to be very enthusiastic when we were up at the Twin Ovals, when they saw the quality of infrastructure that's already there, the fact that we don't have to rezone, the fact that we wouldn't have people, players having to cross busy roads to go to a split site, which was certainly one of the criteria that the state government had set down, that they wanted everything on located on one site. And I think that the really positive thing for Kingborough in all of this is that we will be able to deliver such a project on time, which there is a very strong timeline that the state government have set. I haven't received any feedback from the state government. You may recall when we had when we were all engaged in other matters last Monday night, Clarence Council did debate the matter, and we saw a very unusual situation of the head of the steering committee, who was going to make a recommendation to Minister Street, was actually at the Clarence Council meeting imploring them to vote in support of the recommendation. A highly unusual situation, and one that causes me some concern about the transparency of the process. It is my understanding that rather than wait until the new year, that we can expect to have an outcome this week. So that is a very quick turnaround, and given the size of the submission that we presented and the number of criteria, I'm not sure how a very thorough assessment can be done in that short period of time when both councils have only lodged their submissions last week. So I do hope that ours gets a fair appraisal, because the comparison that we have been able to do between ours and the Clarence one from the publicly available information shows very clearly that ours is superior and can meet all of the criteria that has been set by the AFL. So I look forward to hearing the outcome and hope that for the interests of particularly young aspiring AFL players in Kingborough, that we will have a positive outcome later this week. Councillor Midgley. Oh, sorry, Councillor Bain, did you have another question?
Yes, a question, if that's okay. Just a couple of updates on two capital works projects, if I could, which I know that many community members are very interested in. The first one being the Somerleys Road underpass, and the second one being the Channel Highway footpath between Merton Vale Circuit and United Service Station.
So the Somerleys Road underpass will be, I think, it's been going through the design process at the moment. I know that that's one that the community is very keen to have because of the link under to continue the Whitewater track up towards the Spring Farm area. It's going through design. We haven't been to tender yet. I think it'll be in the second half of next year, if I read the correct thing today. It's certainly, underpasses aren't easy to design, as you can appreciate. And the second one I'll throw to Mr. Smee, who might also just... Oh, no, Mr. Reeve, sorry.
Thank you, Mayor. I'd love to be Mr. Smee one day, but unfortunately haven't got there yet.
Keep wearing shirts like that, you won't.
True. Very true. I got that from my colleague over here. Just to answer the question, so that one's also under design at the moment. So that's the one that's partly funded by council and partly grant funded. So we're hoping to have that one completed early in the new year, with the viewpoint of tendering that out. Once again, that'll probably come on the end of this financial year.
Thank you. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a couple of questions and apologies. I do sometimes give notice to staff, but it's been a very busy weekend. In regards to, the first one is relating to bike racks. So the Kingborough Bicycle Advisory Committee, we did a walkthrough of the main, of the, you know, Channel Highway upgrades and things. And there was a question regarding, so when council is choosing what bike racks to use, e.g. as part of, say, Transform Kingston and other developments, are Australian standard options chosen? And I'm asking this because in regards to the bike rack that is at the new proposed bus stop, we tried to put a bike on there and it was too close to the fence. It wasn't suitable for a frame, bike frame to attach to. They were angled so the bikes could fall over. I'm just wondering what sort of standard options do we decide on when choosing bike racks for our public places?
Who can assist us with this? Mr. Reeve?
Through you, Mayor. Yeah, I guess like any piece of infrastructure we put in place there, we have to be mindful of all the Australian standards and might actually apply to them. Bike racks come in all different shapes and sizes, as you're probably aware. So do we always get it completely right? No, maybe not. So if there is issues associated with any particular installations there, more than happy to actually take those on board there and make sure that there's not something else that we can actually do to actually make them work a little bit better.
Great, thank you. And if possible, if we are deciding on bike racks for different public places, noting that Margate's coming up, would KBAC be able to have a look at what bike racks we're choosing? Because basically the feedback was we don't need sort of funky, stylised bike racks, we just need suitable, usable bike racks. So if that could be possible, that we could do that.
I'm sure Mr. Reeve would be happy to take that on board, I can tell. He's nodding in agreement.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The other one is in regards to my second question about the ferry master plan. And one of the 18 criteria used to pick the top six ferry terminal locations for further investigation was the site is existing and proposed active transport infrastructure. In the ranking for Kingston Beach, it states a strength for the Kingston Beach ferry terminal is that it's good connection to existing pedestrian path and cycleways. I'm wondering what planning are we undertaking in regards to active transport for the proposed ferry terminal at Kingston Beach?
So thank you for that question. So at the moment that master plan is a state government document where there was very little consultation with the councils in relation to that. So we haven't. There was some at an officer level. But apart from that, we were all sort of seeing it for the first time a couple of days before it was released. So I will admit that there were some things in there that we were surprised about, and there was discussion of the sort of commitments that councils would provide financially towards the ferry terminals, to parking, to active transport, etc., etc. So we're still working through that, noting that Kingston Beach is quite a way down the list in terms of the priority sites, that there are more urgent priorities and locations that are far easier at the moment to actually establish a ferry service, because there are some significant difficulties with the water infrastructure that would be proposed, so the jetty that would be proposed at Kingston Beach. As you'll be aware, we have the local area traffic management plan for Kingston Beach that is out for I think it's still out for public discussion and consideration at the moment, so I'm sure as part of that that we would look at that sort of walkability and connectivity for the future when we hopefully do secure a ferry service for Kingston.
Great. Thanks, Mayor. And that was another question relating to that. Is it the acronym LAM, that project that's doing? I think it has been closed because some of the KBAC members did put a submission in because they were concerned about the curb ramp extension and raised platforms and, I guess, then the future of then that making an active transport link. So it's great to hear that we are taking all that into consideration for future planning. The next question that I have is in regards to... is there an improving residential standards document that's currently out for consultation at the moment? Mm. I just heard that there is, and someone was asking if Council's putting in a submission for that one.
Ms. Tyler Moore's put a light on, so she knows the answer.
Through you, Mayor, yes, there is, and it's out on public notification with responses due on the 2nd of February, I believe, and the Planning Department intends on putting a submission in response to that.
Further questions? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. My question is just about the bus stop that is that we're working on, the bus stops, plural, that we're working on the Channel Highway. What's the update on when they will become functional?
I believe it's early in the new year. We've still got some... the bus stop is still actually having the... hasn't even got the seating in yet. The metal frame has been put into place, so there's still some work to do on that. So it will be in the new year, and we're working with... obviously, we need to work with the transport providers, Metro and TassieLink and any others to finalise that and give them notice so that they can advise their drivers. But at this stage, hopefully January, but I don't have a specific date.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? If not, we'll keep moving through the agenda. We're now at questions without notice from councillors. Questions on notice from councillors, and that at the time the agenda was compiled, there were no questions on notice from councillors. We're on page 4 now, petitions still being actioned. There are no petitions still being actioned. But we do have a petition that was received in relation to Snug to Conyngham Shared Pathway with a recommendation on page 4. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder. Moved in Councillor Cordova, seconded in Councillor Fox. Councillor Cordova, did you wish to speak to that?
Thank you. Very briefly, just to commend the community association there and also the many residents of Snug who have been involved and Lower Snug and Snug and Conyngham who have been involved in advocating for what is a really important piece of connectivity. We really want to encourage, I certainly want to encourage active transport and helping people get from place to place with increased mobility and access, but also in such a way that they can be safe from cars and we can get more cars off the road with all of the environmental and social benefits that go from it. I really envisage a Kingborough where people can travel to school, where they can go and see friends, go and get a bite to eat, they can enjoy recreation and they can do it without having to jump into a single passenger vehicle. And I really commend the efforts of the local community there for being so passionate and actually taking the initiative to put this to council. So I'm quietly confident that my fellow councillors echoed that kind of sentiment that we really do encourage local community members to take that initiative and to show us what they want and help demonstrate how we can achieve better connectivity outcomes for all of Kingborough. And I really look forward to Council's response to this excellent petition. Thanks.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Any further discussion? I'll put the recommendation then as printed on the screen, moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. So we're on page 5 now, officers' reports to council, but we're going to flick over to page 37, which is the annual general meeting motion in relation to environmental reports with a recommendation on page 39. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, Councillor Glader.
I move to defer.
Okay, so that's a deferral motion. So it's a procedural motion. Is there a seconder for the procedural motion to defer? Councillor Midgley, you wish to second it? We can't have any debate on a procedural motion, so that's the difficulty. No, a procedural motion needs to be dealt with.
I'll rescind my second then.
Would you like
seconder.
To move to discuss it?
Move to discuss.
Would you like to move to discuss? Just a suggestion to help us out here. Would you like to move to discuss it? To give your reasons as to why you believe it should be deferred or for anyone else to speak to it if we move into discussion and then we can decide what to do.
Sure.
Okay, I've now got a procedural motion that the matter be discussed from Councillor Gladewright with a seconder from Councillor Midgley. Councillor Gladewright.
Oh, I didn't have much to say, just that I...
Beg your pardon. Got confusing there for a moment. Okay, the motion is that the matter be discussed. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Councillor Gladewright.
Thank you. I was just saying that I really appreciate the essence of this motion, but I think it needs a little bit of work to make it a bit more workable for us, and so deferring was going to give it an opportunity to work through some of the things that could be ironed out.
Thank you, Councillor Gladright. Further discussions, Councillor Antoli.
How do you make someone else's motion work? It's their motion. So to change, if I was to bring forward a motion and someone wanted to modify my motion, I'd have to say yes or no. So how do we do this? How does this work? And I don't know what the work is that is required. I'd like to know.
General Manager. General Manager.
Through you, Mayor, the requirements under the legislation don't give us much guidance on that question, Councillor Antoli. From memory, I think it's 72B of the Local Government Act that requires us to hold an annual general meeting. It goes on to talk about motions, and I think 72B6 says that any motions that are passed at a council annual general meeting need to be considered at the next council meeting. So a report's been prepared with a recommendation. If the councillors are of a mind that the matter needs more work, for example, it could be deferred. If the councillors agree with the recommendation, they can choose to accept the recommendation, or if they find that they hold a different position, well, again, that would be a matter for the council to determine. But the unfortunate part about the lack of guidance in the legislation is that because the motion has been moved and seconded by persons who attended the annual general meeting but are not councillors as such, then I'm afraid it's now in the hands of this council to determine the way forward.
I think what the General Manager is, the gist of what the General Manager is saying, if I have this correctly, is that it's not unusual for there to be several pathways that a motion that is passed at an AGM can take. So there is no onus on council to accept a motion that is passed at an AGM. And certainly I can recall in the past where we've had motions put up that instead of rejecting the motions, that we have modified them to make it something workable. It would be very difficult to pass something that has come from an AGM if it creates some uncertainty or lacks clarification for the process that would need to be undertaken. So I do share some the concerns of Councillor Gladright that perhaps I would like to support this motion, but I don't believe, I think there is, in reading the report, there are some questions around, well, what do you regard as an environmental report? We need to set some criteria around, you know, when a report should be, could be deemed not acceptable. I think it needs some of the, almost the procedural stuff around it in order to make it functional and ensure that it's being treated equitably then across all development applications. So I would support that to get the best outcome for the community with this motion that we defer it and do work to get some further clarity around it and then bring it back for us to vote on at a later time in a manner that would work. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I think I have an alternative way forward, which is to suggest that obviously councillors can bring forward their own motion whenever they want to at an upcoming council meeting. If there are some aspects of the proposal before us that councillors think have value and have merit and therefore should be brought to the attention of this council, then I would suggest the best way forward would be to go home, work on it, workshop it, probably talk to the people who originally proposed this motion and see if they can find some common ground there and then submit that to an upcoming council meeting. And the reason I say that is that ultimately I think if we're trying to amend this motion on the fly or worse still is to try and alter this motion Well, I think that the original intention of the motion as I read it, so if we look at 2.1A and B, it clearly says that the council, when requiring an environmental report from a DA from a suitably qualified and insured consultant, that the council honour the findings of the report unless it can be proven to be substandard. That's one area that I think really needs exploration. And the other, as in what is substandard, and based on what merit, what framework, and what legal implications are there of that. And then secondly, in the second component of the proposal, it's that council must provide, if council wish to challenge the findings of an independent report commissioned by the landowner, council must provide two alternative reports at council's expense from two other independent environmental consultants with equal or higher qualifications to the one provided by the landowner. On that basis, I think that if we're going to alter that second component in any way, then really we're undermining the original intention of the proposal, in which case I just don't think that that's appropriate. I think if we like some of the ideas that are within this, then somebody needs to go away and create a motion and bring it back to the council. But I don't think we need to be dealing with this motion. It should come from a councillor that has turned their mind to it. So that's on the kind of procedural thing. If I can just speak to the actual motion, I think it's really important that we look at what it says under finance, 5.1 on page 39. If the motion's supported, the cost to council to obtain alternative reports depends on the scale of the and complexity of the site. It's likely that each assessment would be $2,000 to $8,000, depending on the type and complexity of the report. To paraphrase, Margaret Thatcher famously in 1983 talked about this, where there is no, and I'm going to misquote it a little bit, there is no such thing as council's money, it is public money. So when we're talking about spending $2,000 to $8,000 per report of council's money, what we're actually talking about is passing a motion to require this council to spend public money on something that I think is not reasonable. And the reason I think it's not reasonable is under 8.2, it says that under Section 48 of LUPA, council as a planning authority has a legal obligation to observe and enforce the planning scheme. So this motion proposes to potentially undermine our ability to do that and also charge the people of Kingborough between $2,000 and $8,000 per report. It then goes on to say there is a risk that accepting consultants' reports without the relevant subject council experts undertaking a review, the planning authority is in breach of Section 48 of LUPA. I think it's really important that we don't just treat public money quite so flippantly. I obviously understand the intention behind this, but there really is no such thing as council's money. It's the public's money. And so can you imagine the idea that we're going to subsidise landowners to the tune of between $2,000 and $8,000 for each report that they might need, and there could be many reports that they need. I see this as opening a big can of worms where we're basically funnelling public money into the hands of private landholders. I don't think the other ratepayers would think kindly of that. And importantly, at 4.5... Well, OK, so that's...
Point of order, please. On a motion... On a point of order, please.
Councillor Antolli, on a point of order.
On a point of order of clarity, my understanding...
That's not a point of order.
Well, on a point of order of relevance... we're meant to be discussing deferring. Councillor Cordova is debating the motion.
No, we're not debating whether it should be deferred.
I need to understand,
that's incorrect.
And I must admit I've become completely lost in him just reading whole portions. Hang on, let me finish. Stop badgering me from the left, Cordova.
Councillor Cordova, please just let Councillor Antolli finish. And can I just ask, we're only 50 minutes into the meeting, it's the last one for the year, and I think we should finish it in the way that we started, and that is very collegially. So please, let's just try and be friends tonight. Councillor Antolli.
Thank you, Mayor. On a point of relevance, we're meant to be discussing whether we defer.
Incorrect.
Councillor Cordova, I've asked you not to interject on Councillor Antolli while he's giving his point of order. You'll get your opportunity.
We are discussing Councillor Glade Wright's request to defer, the reasoning behind it. And so Councillor Cordova is debating the motion, and I am at a loss as to understand the relevance.
Yep. So we're actually, because when a procedural motion to defer is before the chair, there can be no debate about it. It's the motion to defer is put, seconded and voted on. And that makes it very difficult then, because the other councillors who are being asked to defer don't know what the reasons behind the deferral. So I suggested to Councillor Gladright that she move for the matter to be discussed so that we could have a discussion about the matter that is before us rather than actually debating the motion. So that discussion, Councillor Cordova is correct in that he can talk about the motion at the moment because we've moved into discussion that the local government meeting procedures regulations allow us to. So this is the opportunity. Whenever we move into discussion, that is the opportunity to discuss the motion that was before us or anything else reasonably connected to it. We're not going to have the red panda or the white panda today. Which colour panda? Red pandas? No red pandas. So we are allowed to discuss the actual motion.
All right. Thank you for clarifying, Mayor.
Thank you. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. Appreciate the explanation. I wanted to, and it's also worth noting that it's up on the screen as well, exactly where we're up to in this debate, that the matter will be discussed, carried unanimously. So people at home can follow that along. I would really hope that at this stage councillors would be able to follow that as well, but nevertheless, 4.7.
Councillor Antoli. Now I'm getting the two of you mixed up. Councillor Cordova. Could I...
Very good.
It's like what I called... Who did I call Councillor Fox the other day? That was a slip-up. Can I just point out that, unfortunately, because of the technical glitch that we have this evening, that the people who are watching this at home cannot see the screen, but we are discussing the matter.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm going to now summarise my position on why I think we should vote on this recommendation, and I do hope that... I'm interested to hear other people's thoughts, but then I do hope that one of our councillor colleagues asks that the motion be then put after we've heard from everybody, because I do think we should vote on this motion. I think we have an obligation that when there's an AGM and the people come to this chamber to speak their mind and to put forward their motions, I think we have a responsibility to the community to actually discuss the motion that they raised, not a motion that we come up with off the top of our heads, but a motion that they raised. Now, if we get ideas from their motions, we can go home, create our own motion and bring it to the council. I think that's valid too. But I really want to deal with the motion as it's been presented, the original motion, which had those two components that I outlined earlier about getting these two other reports at council's cost. I really want to highlight the fact that at 4.7 on page 38, it says Kingborough's approach to assessing reports and requests for further information is consistent with all other southern councils. It's consistent with all of the other southern councils. The other southern councils don't require their ratepayers, they don't require their public to foot the bill for private landowners to get two additional qualifying reports between the cost of $2,000 and $8,000. They don't require that. And the reason for that is that they know their obligations under LUPA, under the Land Use Planning Approvals Act. They know their obligations under Section 48. And they know that as a planning authority, we have a legal obligation to observe and enforce the planning scheme. So that's why they don't do it this way. And that's why we shouldn't do it this way either.
Time.
Thank you.
Point of order.
Absolute offence just then. So as soon as I finished my contribution, Councillor Antoli unprofessionally said, thank God. That's what he just said. And I say offence to that.
I beg your pardon. I did not hear that. But on the point of order, Councillor Cordova, if you have taken offence at that, then I will ask Councillor Antoli, would you like to withdraw the comment that Councillor Cordova is offended by?
I'm sorry he's offended and I don't withdraw.
Are you sure you don't want to rethink that in the spirit of Christmas, Councillor Antoli?
Well, given I just thanked God, I was in the spirit of Christmas.
Unbelievable. Thank you. Councillor Cordova.
My point of order, is there a ruling on that point of order that I take offence to somebody saying thank God when I finish speaking around a council chamber? I'm a councillor, I'm an elected councillor, and I take offence to that. And you wouldn't expect it in state parliament, you wouldn't expect it in any other local government chamber around this state, would you?
I'm checking the local government meetings procedures regulations to see what it is that I am able to do, because I would tend to agree that that was an unnecessary comment, and I'm just trying to determine what capacity I have as chair of the meeting to deal with this. So people will have to bear with us. So I take it your point of order is in relation to 23.1e, which is a statement made by a councillor speaking that the councillor raising the point of order believes is or is likely to believe offensive to a councillor or to another individual.
Correct.
I accept your point of order, and I just can't get an explanation from what I'm looking at to see what I am able to do about it.
At a previous council, they asked people to
I will seek
leave
the wise counsel of the General Manager. General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. I'm also looking at the same section of the Local Government Meeting Procedure Regulations, and whilst it goes on to say that your ruling as chairperson on a point of order is not to be questioned and is binding on the meeting, it gives no guidance as to how you might be able to act other than as you have already.
Which is not helpful. Not
other councils have ejected members for doing that recently. That's been the outcome.
Yeah.
All they would have to do is withdraw what they said.
I'm happy to, for the sake of the audience watching, I'm happy to withdraw the statement of thank God when he finished speaking.
Thank you, Councillor Antoli. I accept that, and I'm sure Councillor Cordova does as well. Councillor Dean, I believe you were next.
I just wanted to clarify and question, because it feels like an age ago that Councillor Cordova was talking about 5.1 and costs. It sounded awfully like Councillor Cordova was suggesting that the ratepayers would be footing the bill of environmental reports moving forward if this was passed. I just want to be clear, or can I just actually clarify, that is not what is happening or what is suggested, what is being suggested, and if in the situation that the findings of those reports would have there would be a difference of opinion, that in that situation, that is when the figure of $2,000 to $8,000 would be coming into effect.
Ms. Tollemore.
Through you, Mayor, I hope I understood the question correctly. The reference to the payment, so if the motion goes through, the council then needs to appoint consultants for that. We expect each report would cost between $2,000 and $8,000, noting that fee can really vary from that and the complexity. So that would be, the motion says that council is paying for that, so it comes out of council money to pay for that. I may have misunderstood the question, sorry.
So. Councillor Dean.
I think so. We are not going to be, or council will not be footing the bill for every environmental report if endorsed. It is in the situation of a difference of opinion when the findings are challenged by council and then going to peer review that additional reports would be requested. Is that correct?
Ms. Tollemore.
Through you, Mayor. The original report is paid for by the applicant as part of their application, which should be lodged at the time of application. If this motion goes through and we have cause of concern about the content of that, the motion is saying that the council will pay for those, not the applicant. And that's what would currently occur now when we do have those occasions when we appoint consultants to review the reports. We would undertake our own and we would brief someone to undertake that.
So it's only in cases when we would seek a second opinion. It's not for every environmental report moving forward.
Through you, Mayor. As I understand the motion, it would be that if we had cause for concern that we disagreed, that every single time we would need to go and get two reports.
It feels like... Look, I'm just going to say that I absolutely support the sentiment. I would like to understand how or who will be reworking this if we move to defer it, because as Councillor Cordova has pointed out, this has been put forward by a member of the public and they do not have access to staff, and they are... So could I just have a clarification on how the process would be if we were to defer it?
If we were to defer it, then there would be some, I guess, based on the discussion that occurs now, which is why we're in discussion, depending on what the feeling of the meeting was about potentially... I don't want to say tinkering with the motion, because that sounds... it's not what I mean, but I guess giving it some rigour that would make it workable as a policy in terms of ensuring that there's clarity around the definitions of what is met by environmental reports. There's clarity around you'd need a definition of, you know, the question of when a report is substandard. You know, what does that... The issues that are raised in the officer's report here have highlighted some, I guess, issues from an implementation point of view if the motion is passed in the way that it has been presented at the annual general meeting. So the time, I guess, staff would listen to the discussion tonight and the will of the councillors to get some feedback on how we could make some recommendations to change the motion to still retain its intent but make it in a workable way, and then bring that back to a further council meeting.
So would there be consultation with the mover of the motion in that process?
General Manager. I'll just ask the General Manager in relation to that. Turn your lights on.
Through you, Mayor. Yes, that would be one of the many things that I'd be suggesting if that is the will of the Council, Councillor Dean. The other thing that I'd be throwing in the mix is that... To give consideration to getting some independent facilitation of that process, because I think if the will of the council is that they support the intent of the motion, but would like to see it resolved in a way that provides maximum clarity, that needs to be provided not only for members of the public and the mover of the motion, but also for the planning officers. So from what I've heard already tonight, I would be, as your soon-to-be-departing General Manager, suggesting that the process might be best facilitated if that was the will of the Council by an independent facilitator to at least engage that discussion, which might involve a workshop or two with the council, before a further report was to come back to council.
Thank you very much.
Councillor Dean.
I'll just then put it on the record, given that we're in discussion here, that would be I'd be in favour of deferring and that process being played out, because I think the intent is there, and if we can iron out some details and come to a more palatable solution for the mover and improve our process as a council moving forward, then I'm supportive.
Thank you, Councillor Dean. Next, I had Councillor Richardson and then Councillor Fox. Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. Just initially got a couple of questions. So what reasons, if a DA comes with a report from a suitably qualified consultant, what reasons might the council have to reject or require additional reports?
So my understanding is that there can be issues with reports that come that are provided to the planning staff where they incorrectly identify a site that is the subject of the DA, or that not all the issues have been addressed. There are some in the discussion points here. There is also includes that there can be, you know, incorrect references to various documents, but Ms. Tyler Moore might like to provide some additional detail.
Through you, Mayor, yeah, that's correct. All those aspects are things that we see that are can be have errors in the reports. It's consistent speaking with the Southern Councils. They face the same issues. It's important that it resolves to provide the advice in accordance with the planning scheme. So occasionally they'll kind of do their own style, if you like, and put the report in it, but it hasn't actually addressed the key elements which are written in the planning scheme. They're written there. We see occasions where a report might conflict with the wastewater report or the hydraulic report. Keeping in mind that we don't just deal with environmental reports, and I think that's important consideration for the motion that you're talking about already, hydraulic reports, your stormwater reports, town planning reports. Sometimes there'll be conflict because maybe the consultant or the applicant hasn't provided the latest version of plans to them, so they're doing an old set of plans where they've moved the shed from here to here and it no longer matches. So they're quite often the issues we have. We also have issues occasionally about methodology, and 37 Nebraska was a good example about that, where we sought some external advice and had to get reviews done in that instance. So there's a whole range of reasons why there is. We don't reject a report. That's not something we do. We may ask for further or amended reports or an addendum to a report to correct or to provide that missing information that's in there.
Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. Excuse me. When providing those requests, if we're not rejecting, bearing in mind we do also ask for peer reviews of reports, what justification, if any, do we provide, does Council provide with the applicant when seeking additional information or peer reviews?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, the further information letter that's sent out will include the details of what's missing from the report, what the error is, and it'll outline what needs to be submitted. So they're quite lengthy, much to the criticism that our further information is a bit lengthy, because we try and provide all that information to make it as user-friendly in terms of so they know exactly what they need to do. I think an important aspect of this review is to actually consider the content of some of those further information requests so that the councillors haven't making an informed decision about what we're actually seeing in that, and that may be part of that process that Councillor Dean asked about, to really understand what it is that's been talked about rather than just taking it that it's always occurring, so that there's a better way to digest what the information is.
Councillor Richardson.
In the case that we request a peer review on a commissioned report and the peer reviewer corroborates or upholds the existing report, what's Council's view, or how do we react to that when essentially we are asking a client to get, or a applicant to spend additional money on additional reports, and the information comes back the same?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, we're not asking the applicant to pay for it. We pay for it. So we'll do an assessment and we'll do those peer reviews. We use them in the instances where we feel that we don't have enough internal expertise on a field. So a good example is a hydraulic report that we recently had, and the two parties worked together, the applicant's engineer and our engineer, to get to the final decision on it. Another example, was not an environmental one, but a traffic report for Lot J, which is the 50 apartments that we have over at Kingston Park, where we, council staff, weren't comfortable with the proposal of having multiple tandem parking arrangements. We had that peer reviewed. The peer review came back in favour of the applicant's traffic engineer. We discussed that with both engineers and the applicant, and we settled to accept their position. So it shows that we do accept when we get the peer reviews. We certainly don't go and shop for someone to suit our argument. And that is an example of where we've done that.
Councillor Richardson.
So just to clarify on that one, when a peer review is requested, is it always that is paid for by us? There's not a circumstance where we request that from the applicant.
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, there'd be occasion where, and I can't cite any examples off the top of my head, but I'm happy to come back, where our peer review conflicts and we suggest that, and we say, well, that's our position because we are the planning authority making the decision on behalf of council. If they really feel so strongly about it, they should get another peer review. So, yes, they would have to pay for that one. But I'd have to actually look through the files to see where we've got examples of that. I've certainly done that. Well, it's occurred at councils I've worked at previously, so it's not an unusual practice. And we would have to ask if you wanted other examples of other councils that take that practice. We can seek that advice as well.
Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. Look, I think it's probably fair to say that the spirit of this motion is fairly well supported. And look, I've got to say, I'm quite disappointed with the report and the response. It kind of devolved pretty quickly into technicality and jargon. And the thing that we really need to think about as we recraft this motion is what we're trying to achieve and how we got to this point. So we're at this point because the community is frustrated. Rightly or wrongly, they feel like a lot of these reports and rejection of reports and requests for information are used in an overzealous manner. So I guess the comment is that we really need to put a lot of effort into examining how we got here and then how we change it. And I'm not particularly interested in, you know, making life difficult for council, but I'm definitely not interested in making life difficult for our people who are trying to get some development applications in place in good faith. So that would be my comment.
Thank you, Councillor Richardson. Next I have Councillor Fox, and then I'll go to Councillor Antoli. Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm looking at the original recommendation, and I'd like to ask whether if we were to pass that recommendation, would that result in the status quo? And I wonder whether I'll get an answer to that first, and then I'll suggest something more.
Given what I'm looking at in 10A, I would suggest it would be the status quo. Can Ms. Tyler Moore, can you please confirm that?
Through you, Mayor, that's correct.
Councillor Fox.
I'm just wondering whether we should look at the... Because the motion was put at an AGM and we need to deal with it tonight, rather than deferring the matter and having a report come back to council, I wonder whether we should in fact support the status quo at this point in time and put a little amendment at the bottom asking for a further report to be prepared by staff following a workshop on the matter by council early in 2024. Which basically achieves the same outcome as deferring it, but I think it's good to formalise the fact that we stay with the status quo until we've had that workshop, because I can hear around the table there's a lot of information that we would like to get from our staff, and it's possibly not the right time to do it the last meeting before Christmas Eve. I'd rather have a relaxed workshop where we can bring in experts and get advice as council rather than making a decision on the run. So my amendment would be that a further report be prepared by staff following a workshop on the matter by council early in 2024.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Just to remind you, we are still in discussion. The General Manager advises me that when we do move out of discussion, if we do then consider a motion of deferral, the motion of deferral would do exactly the same as what you've just suggested, because we've already had the advice that we would move to a workshop in the new year, and in the meantime the status quo would remain. So a deferral would have that same effect. Councillor Fox, do you want to respond to that?
I can understand that, but I just feel that it would be good to have an actual motion on the books, because the motion was originally put by members of the public at an AGM, and I think technically we should actually deal with that motion tonight, even if not just by having a motion of deferral, but having it documented what we're doing and how we've responded so far to the motion.
Thank you. The requirements for Local Government Act in relation to the motions from an AGM just suggest that we need to consider it at the first available council meeting, which we are doing. A deferral would not change that, so we have already met those requirements. It's whether we want to go further with an additional amendment to the substantive motion when we move out of discussion. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. Like Councillor Richardson, I would be likely voting against the officer's report because I believe there's a lot that the spirit of the motion is actually very sound. And I would rather, and I suppose I need to backtrack and thank Councillor Gladewright for bringing the move to defer, because I do believe there is some good stuff there. And I would rather see the good stuff be enjoined on council rather than seeing the whole thing lost and thrown out. So I'm of the mind, and I have an absolute barrage of questions, which I will now save for potentially either later tonight or in a deferment, because my view is if the planning team were required by a motion of council to enjoin the cost onto council for bringing reports to counter what the landowner brings forth. So I reject your report, landowner. We need another report. I have a hunch that we will not be getting a lot of rejections after a while, because the cost would be mounting up, and the CEO and the CFO and the director of that department would be tapping on the door of the manager of the planning team saying, you are costing us a fortune, which is what we currently cost the ratepayers. And I have a hunch that we would actually have quite an expedited process of reports being approved based on their expertise, because we obviously hand out reports to experts because we don't have the manpower in this council to do it ourselves. That's why we do this. So if we're going to be rejecting expert reports because we don't have the resources to do it ourselves, like it was done in the old days, we need to cough up the cost. That's my view. So I would be rejecting the officer's report because I believe it does not align with the spirit and the intent of the motion, and I believe it's a fantastic motion put forward by Ms. Kirkpatrick. So if deferring will get us an outcome rather than it being lost tonight, I'm happy to move, and I don't know if a straw poll would help, Mayor, to help us decide that. Not that I would dare tell you what to do, but just an idea.
Thank you, Councillor Antoli. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I was open to having discussion because there is some good, excellent points that the officers have raised, and there's also some good spirit in the motion that was put forward. So I like that idea of moving forward for a workshop so we can understand all the contexts around it and the pathway that it happens through council and the planning, and to have a really succinct kind of understanding of the processes and perhaps where the communities might be feeling this frustration and why hence that motion was put forward. So that would be good to then understand that. And then once I have that information, then I feel like I can decide on a yes or no decision moving forward.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm going to keep it very brief because essentially my view on this is a combination of Councillor Midgley and Councillor Richardson. There is clearly concern within the community about this issue. We need to recognise that regardless of what our view on the concern one way or the other is. We need to resolve that. I'm not sure that this motion in its current form necessarily gets us closer to where we need to be on that matter, and so I think deferment is a good idea so that we can work through those issues, listen to the community, and hopefully get ourselves to a place where people have confidence in the system that we have in place for these matters.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. Just for the record, I'm also definitely in favour of deferring to get together and reach a much better outcome for the community in line with this motion.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for your contributions. I think everyone's now spoken. From what I gather, I think we could probably shortly come out of discussion and then if somebody wanted to give me a deferral motion, it sounds like there is support to defer the motion with the understanding that in the new year that we wish to have a workshop and do some further work to try and reach a position that would be one that is both workable for council but also acceptable to improving things for members of the community. So I will now move out of I need somebody to move that we move out of discussion, please. Councillor Street, seconded Councillor Richardson. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Okay. We're just moving. thank you. The motion is carried unanimously. I'm now seeking the guidance. If anybody, Councillor Gladewright, would you like to put your microphone on, please?
I move to defer.
Thank you. I have a procedural motion to defer. I'm looking for a seconder for that. I've got a seconder in Councillor Dean. There is no debate on a procedural motion, so I will put the motion to defer. Moved by Councillor Gladewright, seconded by Councillor Dean. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? A show of hands is required. All those in favour? Is Councillors Antoli, Dean, Bain, Midgley, Richardson, Street, Gladewright and Reet? And those against? Is Councillors Fox and Cordova? So the motion is carried. That now takes us to page 40. Consideration of another AGM motion on stakeholder engagement with a recommendation on page 42. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. I've got a mover in Councillor Midgley and a seconder in Councillor Cordova. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. After reading the motion again and reading the discussion pages on page 40 and 41, the officers have covered that succinctly in regards to processes and procedures in regards to Council's communications and engagement framework, so I support the recommendation put.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Further discussion? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. If I could ask a question regarding 2.1A.
Excuse me, sorry, could I just pause for a moment? Lovely to have members in the public gallery here, but it's very difficult to hear the debate when there's a discussion going on in the public gallery, so could I ask you please to refrain from that, so because we also have the recording that we're trying to get on tape. I'm just asking you please to... No, I couldn't hear what you were saying, but there was background noise coming that was interfering with me listening to the councillors who have been speaking, and I noticed that other councillors were straining to hear what was being said by councillors who have been speaking. So I would ask, please, that you remain respectful of the standing orders and the meeting regulations that we have. We welcome all members of the community to be here, but you're asked to watch in silence, please. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. My question is around the mover of the motion, Mr. Biggins. It's 2.1A. He makes the point about from actual stakeholders directly affected by the proposed council decision. So the question I have is, how do we currently capture this common sense issue? So obviously we want to take into account people who are directly affected. How do we capture this, and what weighting do those who are directly affected have in the analysis compared to maybe an expert who's not from the community? Because you make very good points in the officer's report around that. I'd just like to know, how do those directly affected, how is their opinion weighted compared to everyone else's?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, as I've indicated in the report, identifying who is directly affected in some instances will be quite easy. For example, if you've got a development that only impacts on the surrounding neighbours, it's quite easy to identify who's directly affected. But in other instances, the whole community could potentially be directly affected, and it's a really difficult task to try and determine which community members are directly affected and who isn't. So to answer the question, generally speaking, we would provide a higher weighting to directly affected stakeholders. However, as discussed in the report, there will be instances where we may wish to and give a weighting to the input from stakeholders who may not be directly affected, but for whatever reason, they bring something important to the table and their view is important to us.
Councillor Ntoli.
Thank you. That's a very helpful answer. The only contribution I would make is that I think I understand definitely the sentiment, the intent and the outcome that the author of the motion wants to get. I think the officers, and to be honest with you, I think the majority of what is requested that we capture is captured by council. And there are times when council does not vote in favour of the officer's report or in favour of the majority view. And sometimes we vote in favour of the majority view, but we amend based on the minority view, which is very important. So I do think that we have a pretty comprehensive way of capturing the information. But I understand the frustration, perhaps, that the author is communicating to us from the community, that they find it really hard to go through a development process and to have their plans thwarted by people who they don't perceive to be directly affected, direct stakeholders around their property. So having shared that, I will probably be accepting the officer's report because I do think it gives a balanced view and does take into account the way council currently works, not withholding the frustration the author probably feels about the process.
Thank you, Councillor Ntoli. Further contributions? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I agree with the recommendation, and the reason for that is, as has already been touched on, I guess we have this perception that when it's a development application, for example, it's the adjoining property owners who are the directly affected stakeholders. When it comes to an engagement process, for example, Kingston Beach local area traffic management, I go down to Kingston Beach a lot. I don't live in Kingston Beach, but I go down there a lot. So who's the directly affected stakeholder in that example when I spend probably more time down there than maybe some of the people who actually live there because I go down there a lot? Maybe not, but maybe I do. So there's things like around the, you know, regional assets. You know, if we look at our playgrounds, for example, decisions around Kingston Park, you know, that affects a whole lot of people who may not be adjoining landowners to the Kingston Park development, but they might be affected by, you know, the traffic or the environment or any of the other flow and effects. So that's why I think it's not as clear as that. And I draw our attention to at 4.5, the numbers for and against a proposal are a valid consideration for council, but are not the sole factor in determining whether to proceed or not. And I agree with that sentiment. There's this old adage about democracy sometimes is just two wolves and a lamb arguing about, you know, having a vote on what should we have for dinner. You know, if we just have a simple first past the post vote on, you know, the majority of people think this, then we'll do it. Well, actually, that leaves out a lot of the nuance that is involved in good governance and thinking about the best interests of the community and putting the community at the heart of everything we do. So it can't be as simple as just the numbers. It has to have that nuance and that and that behind it. Then the final point that I wanted to raise was that we already are using a system, which I think is a good one, but it's really worth elaborating on for the community, that the system that's known as the IAP2 Spectrum of Public Participation, it helps clarify the role of the community in planning and decision making. And the way in which it does that is by setting different levels, almost hierarchical levels, of what kind of an engagement process it is. So the various levels are to inform, to consult, to involve, to collaborate, and to empower. And those are very different expectations. So an example of council informing the community is when we inform people what the rates notice will be. This year it will be that. But before that process, we've engaged in a much more involved process where we ask the community, what do you think the rates should be? And then we listen to that and tailor our decisions accordingly. So an example of collaboration is much more involved when the council actually asks for collaboration in their consultation. That's much more involved than simply informing people of what the decision is going to be. So it's an important hierarchy to understand, and it's, I think, behoves the council, and I think we do a good job of this, to try and explain what level of engagement we're actually going to have in a given consultation. I used the example previously about in some weeks ago that we didn't go out to public consultation on the council's internal fraud policy because it's almost, irrespective of what some members of the community might think about our internal fraud policy, we thought it's really important to have that policy, and we're informing the community about what that internal fraud policy looks like. We're not asking to collaborate with the community on deriving what our internal fraud policy looks like. Whereas when it comes to other issues that, really more affect the community on a day-to-day level, such as traffic management at Kingston Beach, of course we go out to actually collaborate with the community and co-produce an outcome. So those different levels are really important to understand. Ultimately, I think the conclusion is apt, where it says that whilst the intent of the resolution from the AGM is well-intended, it is not considered that they are equitable, best practice, or feasible to implement. Accordingly, it's recommended that the council does not adopt the proposals as part of its community engagement process, and I largely agree with that assessment.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Further contributions? Councillor Fox.
Item B on page 40, it does concern me that the suggestion is that if there is a, well, if the stakeholders have been consulted, that council may not or doesn't proceed against the will of stakeholders. At the end of the day, the council is elected democratically. The final decision rests with council, and it wouldn't be wise of us to adopt a position where the stakeholder engagement would override the democratic process of councillors who have a broader view of what council's role is, what other priorities there are, and what's affordable for the community. So I would support the recommended motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Any further contributions? Councillor Midgley, did you want to sum up? Now, I'm going to put the recommendation now. It's moved by Councillor Midgley, seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried unanimously. So we now go back to page 5, and managing conflicts of interests of councillors, with a recommendation on page 8. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder. I've got a mover in the Deputy Mayor and a seconder in Councillor Midgley. Deputy Mayor.
Thank you. So the purpose of this report is to enable Council to respond to the Office of Local Government release of a discussion paper titled Managing Conflicts of Interests of Councillors. The recommendation is that we provide the General Manager with delegation to respond to the framework. Whilst the thrust of the framework is recommended for support, this report has identified areas requiring further clarification. And, for instance, occasions where a councillor will not be able to determine whether they have a conflict of interest in a matter until they read a council meeting agenda. So I feel comfortable with providing the delegation to the General Manager. He's identified some areas of concern and is going to seek some clarification around those things, so I'm happy to support this motion.
Thank you, Councillor Gladright. Any further discussion? I just wanted to make a brief comment, just that I believe, and always have done, that we need to have a thorough conflict of interest register for members of councils. We don't have one across local government in Tasmania. They do in other states. And we also do have it for state and federal members of parliament. And as a council, I know that we had talked in the past that we would provide our own policy around this, but then the state government had started doing the work on this that they're now seeking our feedback in. I know that from speaking to the General Manager that there have been a range of issues that have been highlighted, excuse me, at a workshop at workshops that they've had, and I believe those are highlighted in the report and certainly do need some clarifications around the different circumstances that can arise. So I'm satisfied that we should support this recommendation and provide the General Manager with the delegation to give a submission to the State Government. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I agree with the intention behind behind the motion, and as has been said, there are some holes here, and one of the clear holes is that until councillors have read the agenda, sometimes it's hard to know where they have a conflict, and if the mechanism by which it's determined that somebody has a conflict ends up being that the chair of the meeting just gets to decide in advance, well, I think that councillor might have a conflict over there, so I will withdraw material from them. I think that is fraught, and therefore I think that there's clearly, in terms of the mechanism and implementation, that there needs to be some work done there. I just wanted to raise the point that this is something that our council, I brought a motion to this council on the 3rd of October in 2022, that was that the register of interests pertaining to each elected councillor should be published on the Kingborough Council website in the same or similar manner to that published by state and federal politicians. And whilst it didn't get up then, I think it's really good now that as a whole the state is coming around to this idea that we should be held as local government, in the local government setting, we should be held to the same standard of account as we would expect state and federal politicians to be. And I actually think that that leaves a fair bit to be desired, to be honest. It's a fairly low benchmark to fill, is to be up there at the same level of professionalism and standards as state and federal politicians. So I think at the very least council can do that and should do that. And that's why I welcome this initiative. But of course we need to make sure that in implementing the initiative, as I've outlined, we need to make sure that it's robust and that it's fit for purpose and that it doesn't inadvertently undermine what it seeks to achieve. So I support the motion. Thanks.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Any further discussion? Councillor Gladewright, did you want to sum up? No, I'm going to put the motion then. It's moved by Councillor Gladewright, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. That takes us now to page 9, Draft Child Safety Policy and Statement of Commitment, moved by Councillor Gladewright, seconded by Councillor Midgley. Councillor Gladewright.
Councillor Midgley and I were having a race to see who could put our light on first. I note that we both really wanted to move this one, but I just beat you, sorry. So the purpose of this report is to adopt a policy and statement of commitment relating to Council's obligations under the Child and Youth Safe Organisation Act 2023, which comes into effect in a couple of weeks' time. Additionally, Recommendation 6.12 of the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse defined a role for local government. So in response, we have produced a draft child safe policy and a draft child safe statement of commitment, which is one of the first steps in becoming a child safe organisation. But I do note that there is further work still to do in reviewing and updating internal policies and practices, delivering staff training and embedding child and youth safe practices across the organisation where they do not already exist. So I understand that this is just the first step along this journey. There is still a lot to do, but I'm really happy to support this tonight. I'm really proud that we're one of the first councils to be taking our initial steps along this journey, and I believe that all levels of government should be exemplars of child safeguarding, so I'm happy to support the motion.
Thank you very much. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. Yes, absolutely. This is a really important policy come out of unfortunate circumstances, but it is for putting children at the centre of all of health and safety and wellbeing. So it is great. And yes, thanks to the staff for getting onto this, seeing it as a priority that's come out of the Act, which, as Councillor Gladewright said, comes into effect on the 1st of January 2024. I just have a question in regards to the template. So we've used the template provided by LGAT, and then is the statement of commitment also part of that template?
Mr. Spinks, our Director of People and Finance, can help us with that. If somebody else turns their light off, please.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor. No, that's not a template. What we've done is done a bit of a search, as you tend to do in local government, of sort of other examples, and we've tried to pick the eyes out of what we consider to be the better examples from others who have already done a statement, and that's how we came up with ours.
Great, thank you. It's an excellent statement. So I guess in regards to, because noting that the independent regulator hasn't been appointed to kind of oversee this at the moment, so in a way we are ahead of the game, and then I guess as we're going through this policy, just noting that it's till 2025, so it's 2 years. I guess if the independent regulator kind of looks at local government's statement of commitments and things like that, they could recommend changes, so we'd be open to that sort of, if there had to be changes, even though we've got a 2-year time frame, is that correct?
Yes, we can do that at any time.
Yeah, great, thank you. And I guess in regards, just a couple of questions that I had through that. So I guess in regards to the policy as well, so what information, I guess, has been provided from LGAD in regards to, like, what we kind of put in the policy? Have we been given some guidance in regards to that?
So the template came from LGAD.
Yes.
It was similar to one that the Derwent Valley have passed.
Yes. Yep.
It's basically a copy of theirs.
Great. Thank you. I had heard that in my community development, colleagues that I know across the state. So I guess just, can I ask a couple of questions just in regards to the policy, and I guess just that understanding that kind of procedure from council. One of the first questions on page 14, so under procedure, it's got there documenting, reporting and record keeping procedures related to this policy. I guess so in regards to if there was an unfortunate incident where there was harm to a child or something like that, in regards to sort of, do staff take like case notes or how I'm
so
just wondering.
What page of the agenda are you
so
on?
So page 14.
Of the, yep.
Yeah, the procedure, yep. The policy, yep. Detail. So I guess just understanding that documenting, reporting and record keeping procedures related to this policy, I'm wondering what that looks like.
Mr. Spinks.
Thank you, Mayor. Look, it's fair to say we're still developing this. I have said in the report, and I think I mentioned at last meeting, we intend to do is to form an internal working group across the business just to sort of work through these kinds of issues. We'll continue to work with LGAT and the LGO, who will sort of continue to put out more guidance and some more meat on the bones for some of these things, but I can't be sort of more specific than that at this point, but we'll continue to work through these issues.
Great, thank you. I've got a few more questions, Mayor, just in regarding those issues. I hope that's okay.
Of course.
So 5.1.2, page 15, it's provide resources for staff awareness and staff training related to this policy. So in regards to kind of training, was there any kind of guidance around how often staff participate in child safeguarding training? So I guess you'll work that out in the working group in regards to that as well, because it is one of those things in a lot of organisations currently who have good child safeguarding practices is they do annual kind of child safeguarding practices, safeguarding training. So hopefully, I guess, moving forward, we can consider, the time frame for that as well.
We haven't received any guidance.
Mr. Spinks.
Mayor. Again, I think I said at the last meeting, it was in 2019 when I last did some sort of training in this kind of space, so as we sort of get our heads together and work this out a little bit more, I think it's inevitable that we have to do training and more often.
Great. Thank you.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. Okay, page 17, 7.1.5. It's a great statement. We want children to thrive, be happy, safe and empowered. And then it says they're given opportunities to contribute to how we plan and deliver our services which affect them. So for me, that is very much a statement around how we kind of engage with children and young people. And just noting in our current kind of engagement policy, we don't really have anything specific to how we engage with children and young people. So I guess that would be great to move forward to think about how then council includes children and young people in that one.
Thank you.
And also just noting as well that, I'm sure that staff have EAP available, because there's a few comments that I guess in the policy as well that relate to kind of supervision and things like that. So, yeah,
yes.
That's good to know. other one, sorry, just looking at my notes. Just my further notes here. Oh, so I guess when we make sort of statements around on page 19, providing environments for children and young people where they feel safe, empowered and can participate, behave safely and appropriately with children and young people, I think it's all good and fair enough that we have a great policy that, you know, elected members, staff, contractors and all that sort of thing are aware of. But I guess in regards to that, it would be great to develop some sort of a commitment or a statement to children and young people in children and young persons' language to let them know that it actually is a safe place to be, that as council we are committed, our statement of commitment, I guess, to children and young people so they feel safe, respected and heard. And it'd be great to have something like in child-friendly language so that if we are providing services or if we've got a youth group coming in and doing something, that children know that that is actually, you know, it's their rights, basically.
Well, Councillor Midgley, just on that, hopefully when we've got through the 2610 plain English training, then everything that we produce should be in a language that can be understood by all in the community and we shouldn't have to change it for young people.
Yeah, and I guess if we did have like a way that we're engaging with young people off the YACS active, that we can run sort of things past them as well. And also in regards to, so I guess it's that council's child safe commitment, like if that can be in a language that is friendly for children and young people, they sometimes might use different words than what we might use. And in regards to also, so if young people are feeling unsafe, if whether it's a contractor or an event or something like that, it'd be great to really think about then if children need to talk to someone, how are they provided that information? Anyway, they're just a few points that I've thought about reading this. And in regards to, I guess, just really noting that it is going to be a lot of work, like behind the scenes, to get a lot of these procedures and things in place. It is a really important thing, but I just really note that, you know, it's different. I've personally ran many events when I was at City of Hobart for children and young people with a taste of Tasmania. And yes, you know, you checked your working with vulnerable children card, but then now if these contractors are required to do then child safeguarding practices, I guess I just know there's going to be a lot of admin in regards to that as well. So noting that there is going to be a bit of a noted in one of the things in the points there that, you know, there is going to be a lot of work there for council to do the admin and procedures and things like that. And I guess not only they participate in the child safeguarding, we'll be checking their current working vulnerable children cards, we'll be have to check that they actually attend that child safeguarding, that when they come as a contractor to provide activities for children, that we have to make sure that contractor attended that sort of a thing. So there's lots of procedures, I guess, and things in place, which is really fantastic. But I guess I just want to note that, and I guess it would be great, you know, thinking about some of these smaller councils who don't have the resources and staff to kind of put these sort of things together. I guess it's a bit of a callback really to the state government to say, well, it'd be great if they put additional resources in place to ensure that councils are able to fulfil the obligations of the Act. So I guess I just wanted to make that statement. If it would be interesting to hear at the LGAP meetings if other councils track how other councils around the state are actually going with this, because it is a lot of body of work. And so I guess if there's any way we can say to someone out there, it would be great if they put resources into this. It would be great.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Just in relation to that, this has been something that both LGAT and the General Management Committee have been raising with the state government for quite a few months now. I think it was about August when we wrote the first letter to the Attorney General raising concerns. We then wrote again in September, wrote again in October, and it was raised at the Premier's Local Government Council meeting the week before last, because there is a great deal of concern about the fact that this comes into force on the 1st of January next year. There is, as such, no independent regulator, even though we were assured at that meeting by the gentleman from the Department of Justice that there would be, that an announcement was imminent, to paraphrase one of our staff, but that hasn't been forthcoming so far. They'd previously tried to appoint somebody to the role and were not successful. So there is a great deal of uncertainty in right throughout councils in the state about what happens when the clock ticks over to the 1st of January and this comes into force, because it is not clear despite what's been put out already, what the full responsibility on councils would be, and certainly the position of the Local Government Association that we have put to the Premier and to the Minister for Local Government is that either LGAT or preferably LGAT needs to be funded with some resourcing to work through these issues, because as you quite rightly highlight, it is small councils in particular who are really going to struggle with the implications of this. So yes, we do have significant concerns. The latest letter that we got in response to a letter that the President of LGAT, Mick Tucker, sent to the Attorney General, their response was completely unsatisfactory, and I would term it as a brush off. And so the President will be writing another letter. But we have expressed directly to the Premier our concerns about, we all have the best interests at heart here of making sure that we can say that we have the policies and procedures in place to be regarded as a child-safe organisation to protect members of our community. But this is being put through in such a hurry by the state government that we don't know whether this is going to be a process that is actually effective. And I think it is going to be a lot of work for councils. And what the resourcing requirements directly to us at the moment will be is really unknown. Mm. So it is very much a watch this space. And so that's why in your question earlier about, you know, would we change the policy in the 2 years before it's up for review? We may need to, depending on what happens when the independent regulator does come to that position. I understand that LGAT are meeting with Department of Justice this week as well to try and get some further clarity before the Christmas break for councils.
Great. Thanks so much, Mayor. And just one further question. The Child Safe Statement of Commitment, so that will be on the website and displayed in yes. council buildings, is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Mayor. I just have a simple question. There's no such thing, of course. When I had a grandchild at primary school, I had a working with vulnerable people's card, which expired. I then tried to renew it, but I was unable to do so as a councillor because I wasn't directly involved with an education department or a school or any other group, and I was literally unable to get my working with vulnerable people card, not for any reason other than my lack of involvement directly. I'm just wondering how this isn't covered in the report that councillors will be issued with one of these, because we are not employees. Most people around this table are, I mean, we're all elected, but we all have different affiliations and not necessarily with groups that would allow us to get a vulnerable people's card. And I'm just wondering if we have a resolution to that issue.
There must be some way of getting them. I know many councillors who have working with vulnerable people cards. Mine had expired and I got a new one because I'd had one when I was on the School Association of Kingston High School, and then I realised that it expired. And I believe all of us as councillors should have them, because it's a requirement of many schools that you visit that you actually do produce your card, otherwise you can be denied entry under their policies. But if there is some barrier, then we certainly need to draw that to the attention of the state government, because I'd hate to think that there was something at their end that would prevent anybody around this table. I imagine most people have got one anyway. But if you're experiencing barriers, that's something that I'm sure the Director of People and Finance will communicate to the state government in this process. And certainly I'll take that on board and take it back to LGAT as well.
I did actually raise the matter with our General Manager at the time, and he was unable to help me. And also when I have attended schools, I've stated that I don't have a card, and they've said as long as I'm in attendance of adults at the time, then there's no issue. So I have been attending school functions. But it does make me feel uneasy, and I think as councillors, when we have a report like this in front of us, we shouldn't be disadvantaged.
Thank you. Councillor Minchley, have you got another question?
Yes, I'll frame it in a question. I'm quite sure that as part of the Act, schools will be very strict in regards to working with vulnerable children cards. Am I correct? Does anyone know if I'm correct in that? I just know because I visit schools all the time and their process is a lot stricter, so I don't know if anyone else has experienced that.
Look, it does vary from school to school, I think, but certainly it would be my advice that if you don't have a card that you try and secure one. Councillor Antoli.
Yes, the question is around, I suppose it's bouncing off what Councillor Fox said. I work in child safety. I have a working vulnerable people card. I do believe she is correct to say that unless you fall into certain categories, you can't actually apply for one. And I'm not too sure what the exemption is. But however, let us say we move to that policy where we require councillors to have one. So we have a situation perhaps where a duly elected councillor cannot get one. What do we do legally then to him or her?
Very good question. I'm looking at the General Manager.
Current councillors too. So
looking at the Director
Councillor
of
Fox
and
might
Finance.
Have to resign from council then. I don't know. I'm a joke. That's a joke.
Director of People and Finance is going to take that one on.
Mayor, can I suggest that that's the very kind of issue that we need to be taking up with LGAT and the LGO to canvass on our behalf and help us work out some solutions?
Thank you.
Another question.
Councillor Midgley, on another question.
I do. I have another question on this one. So if then we're looking at the process of different staff among council, say, needing a working vulnerable children card, and then we find out that they are not, they basically can't get one due to records, that will be an interesting process to ask LGAT as well.
It will be.
It's already affected the mayor, the former mayor of Launceston.
Yes, it has. It has. Are there any further contributions or questions? I just have a question that I'm hoping Mr. Spinks could answer. What are the implications for this policy on us in terms of individuals or organisations that we hire our facilities out to? So could be the local hall or, that some community group might want to borrow. Do we? Will this new legislation, as of next year, will that have an onus on us to ensure that anybody that we're hiring the facilities out to, who is going to have people under 18 on site, that they demonstrate in some way that they have working with the vulnerable people cards, or are we? Where does the line of responsibility stop?
Mayor, I think the best answer to that one is that that issue arises more out of the separate recommendation 612 rather than the framework itself. I think it's fair to say the implications of that recommendation 612 and what it means to us are even less clear than the framework. So I think it's just a case of watching that space and, as I say, work with LGAT and LGO to work out the implications of that.
And I think the other concern that LGAT had articulated that there still seems to be confusion about is what would occur, whether it's council then, who sporting clubs and other associations who permanently hire some of our facilities come to for advice on how to become a child safe organisation, which we just wouldn't have the resources to do, and that's where the resourcing of it comes. Councillor Cordova, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mayor. Not a question, just my very brief contribution to say that I support this motion and I think it's a good step forward, and indeed Council is acknowledging by passing this motion that it has a leadership role in our community in relation to the safety of children and young people. I think it's been a good discussion to try and tease out some of the implementation factors and how we operationalise this and really embed it into our operations. I draw our attention to 5.2 and on page 11 and the internal working group that's to be established to determine that implementation and those impacts on council. I assume that in due course we will find out the timeline for that and also any relevant workshops that councillors will undertake. And the reason for that is I note that at the end of page 20, under processes for responding to and reporting a suspected child abuse, it says simply contact Kingborough Council on the phone number 62118200 for the various ways by which you can report your concerns or speak to a member of council staff. I think it's going to be critically important in terms of our responsibility as elected members, which you can read on page 17, not just modelling a culture of child safety and wellbeing, but councillors specifically also have a role in helping to promote Kingborough Council as a child safe organisation and to direct community members to appropriate information and resources. And so I really just want to drive the point home that I think it would be really worthwhile councillors having not just the regular training but also specific training about how we can best exemplify that role, that we know exactly what to do and how to really bring this policy to life. Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Cordova, I certainly agree with those comments. If there are no further contributions, Councillor Gladewright, would you like to sum up? No? I'm going to put the recommendation now. It's moved by Councillor Gladewright and seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried unanimously. Time being 7:30, I think if everyone who's watching along at home could just be patient with us, we will have a little comfort break and we will be back here in 6.5 minutes. Thank you. That's okay. Okay, welcome back. Thank you for your speed in getting back and welcome back to the people who are watching along at home on YouTube, including our communications advisor who is on holidays but has told me she's watching. Yeah. Can I just confirm with the General Manager that the recording has restarted?
Confirm, yeah.
Thank you very much. Now, we are at the, just get my place here, page 21, Treasury Management Policy 3.8 with a recommendation on page 23. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. A mover in Councillor Cordova, seconder in Councillor Bain. Councillor Cordova, just before I ask you to speak to it, there is a small amendment in an error that we picked up and I'll ask Mr. Spinks to just point out where that is.
Thank you, Mayor. So I'm on page 33 of the agenda, and section 5.2.1. So this is the clean version of the policy, section 5.2.1, which begins by saying, Council may deposit funds with any Commonwealth, state or financial institution having a rating as prescribed in section 6.1.2. So it's just to replace section 6.1.2 with the word below.
So that is actually up on the screen at the moment, so you can see the alteration that Mr. Spinks is talking to. So it was just the referencing. It referenced a section which is not there. So it now just says below, and then it follows on. So if you're all happy with that, I'll call on Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, ma'am. And this is a really important, it's a really important policy, and a lot of the changes are fairly prosaic. So one being, for example, changes have been made to reflect the title change of the Chief Financial Officer to the Director of People and Finance. And except for those minor changes, it's considered that the policy remains appropriate. It's really important, I think, and what I'll be focusing on in my contribution tonight is that Council takes a risk-based approach to managing its investment portfolio. The main risks covered are credit risk, liquidity risk, refinancing risk, interest rate risk, and sustainability risk. And Council may invest any money in any manner in which a trustee is authorised by law to invest trust funds and in any investment that the Treasurer approves according to Section 75 of the Local Government Act. So, yes, these are minor changes, but I do want to draw our attention to, I guess, the importance of this policy in general. And one thing that I think is a very worthy contribution that has been that has been added to it in years gone by is 5.15, 5.1.5, sustainability risk. Council gives preference to fossil fuel-free authorised deposit-taking institutions when making deposits if, and there's a couple of caveats below. Now, why do I draw our attention firstly to sustainability risk? Is because council is recognising that if we don't have an environment then that's working for humanity, then we don't have an organisation that's working with its people at the heart of everything it does. So that's why we have some of those elements there. But I wanted to ask the question about whether consideration has been given to, among those risks, has consideration been given to reputational, cultural or moral risk? And I'll just extrapolate on that before I guess I ask the question. Many superannuation firms right now, as we speak, are grappling with the idea of whether or not it is appropriate to, for example, divest their funds from, one example is business enterprises that are involved in activities on illegal settlements throughout the occupied Palestinian territories. In February 2020, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights released a report, database of all businesses involved in the activities detailed in paragraph 96, as a result of an international fact-finding mission to investigate the implications of the Israeli settlements on civil, political, economic, social and cultural rights of the Palestinian people throughout the occupied Palestinian territory. Now, I haven't suggested an amendment to this Treasury report because it requires really good deliberation about under what circumstances to be fair and equitable and to, you know, if you're going to raise one humanitarian crisis and the need to divest from unethical behaviour, then you need to be methodical and have a framework within which to do that. But I think we do all agree now that it is appropriate that we don't invest public money, council's funds, in, for example, tobacco. I would hope that we all agree that it's not appropriate to invest council's funds in certain elements, you know, weapons, or indeed, as we already have in the sustainability risk element, we don't, where possible, where appropriate, we don't invest in fossil fuel, or we try to invest in fossil fuel-free authorised deposit-taking institutions. So my question is, to what extent have we considered the reputational risk of council's money? Because ultimately, money, what we do with our money really does matter. It has a high impact. And my question is, for this council, have we considered the reputational impacts of where our money sits with specific underlining what's going on, for example, right now in Gaza or in any of the other humanitarian crises we see around the world? Has the council considered reputation, morals or culture, the organisational culture that is impacted by our Treasury management?
Mr. Spinks.
Through you, Mayor. Look, we did give that some consideration. The challenge we find will be how to obtain that information and assess. One of the, I guess the way we're able to sort of do the sustainability risk is that there's a website out there called Market Forces who does an assessment of institutions, whether they're fossil fuel supporting or not. So it's quite an easy task for us to ascertain for each institution. For those sort of more broader moralistic kind of assessments, I think it would be very challenging for us to be able to sort of obtain that information as to whether any given bank or institution is supporting any of those pursuits or have clients that are in those industries, etc., etc. So we did give it some consideration, but we decided to not try to incorporate it into the policy.
Thank you, Matt. To conclude my remarks, I would just say that our Treasury management policy, whilst it might seem like it's something that is just a tick and flick kind of exercise, that it's important to have one for the various risks that council faces, I also think that it's important that we reflect on the strategic outcome which underpins this entire management policy, which is that the organisation has a corporate culture that delivers quality customer service, encourages innovation and has high standards of accountability. And it's on that last element of this, the high standards of accountability, that I think it's worth us reflecting on, that there are certain community expectations out there that we are going to be a leadership organisation, and we've certainly demonstrated that in our last agenda item, but it's I think it's really important that we reflect on how important where we park our money is It's important for our reputation, it's important for our organisational culture, and ultimately it's really important for the impact, hopefully the positive impact that we can create, not just here in Kingborough, but further afield as well. So once again, I want to thank the author and the authoriser, or for the first time, I want to thank the author and the authoriser for putting together a great report, and I commend the motion.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. What is a fossil fuel-free authorised deposit-taking institution, and can I have an example?
Mr Spix.
Through you, Mayor. So it's simply a banking institution that that funds the fossil fuel industry or not. So lots of institutions do. Increasing numbers of institutions no longer do. And as I said, how we make that assessment is through an information website called Market Forces, who does all of that homework for us.
Thank you.
Councillor,
my next question is, so we would be happy to deposit with said taking institution if the rate was higher than everyone else?
Mr Spinks.
Through you, Mayor, that's correct. That's what the policy provides for.
And if the rate was equal to everybody else, we would reject that particular deposit organisation?
Mr Spinks.
Mayor, subject to the other limits in our policy in terms of how much would it, certain institutions or credit rating, that kind of thing. So subject to that, yes, we would place money with a non-fossil fuel supporting where possible.
What would happen if a climate activist found out we had put money into an institution where everything at the time was equal, we chose it and we made a mistake, and it was actually a fossil fuel taking deposit? What would we do then?
Mr Spinks.
Mayor, having come across that circumstance either here or elsewhere where we've had similar policies, But my response would be more than likely we'd let the investment run its course and then we would reinvest next time.
So it's fair to say that you would be looking at the financial best interests of the council's returns ahead of any assessment on the moral values of fossil fuel?
At the moment, Mayor, that's what the policy provides for. We choose to select in ethical institutions where their rate matches or is better.
Okay. Well, I have no problems then with accepting the policy, then, as long as the best interests of the council's finances are at heart.
Thank you, Councillor Antoli. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. Just have a question around 5.9.4 on page 27, just with the heading there, reporting. We've added in, where additional borrowings are required, prior to any borrowing, the request will be included with the budget papers or a separate report will be prepared for Council's approval, highlighting the following with a few dot points, which is great. I'm just curious as to what used to happen previously before this version. It mentions maybe it was done once a year, or was it done other times but it wasn't written to this document?
Mr
Spinks. Yeah, so the current version of the policy provides for an annual report to be provided to Council at the start of every year, and that we haven't been doing that, and it just seems an unnecessary practice anyway. So in practice, what happens is any proposed borrowings are going to be discussed through our discussions around the long-term financial plan, our annual budget. There'll be a formal resolution as part of the budget, so it would get approved through that mechanism. In the event that we wanted to undertake some further borrowings outside of the budget cycle, then we would put up an additional report to Council seeking approval.
Great. Thank you.
Is there any further discussion? Councillor Cordova, did you want to sum up? Thank you. I'm going to put the motion then. It's as moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Bain. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. That now takes us to over the page. We're on page 43, nominations for representation on the Kingborough Community Safety Committee, with a recommendation on page 45. Got a mover in Councillor Gladewright and a seconder in Councillor Midgley. Councillor Gladewright.
Thank you. So we're discussing the Kingborough Community Safety Committee. There are two elements to the recommendation. The one is the appointment of the nominations. The second part of the recommendation is around putting the committee on notice for a year. We discussed in the last committee meeting how the committee members thought the value of the committee was providing to council, and the deputy chairperson and I had a chat as well with Mr. Reeve and the executive officer, and asked their opinion as well about what sort of value the committee was providing. As chair, my observations were that we were getting a lot of issues being raised on state growth roads, which would result in a letter to the minister, which would come back with a fairly non-response. We were also getting a lot of service requests, which really could be dealt with outside of a committee setting with a simple email. And we were also discussing things that the officers were already preparing as budget deliberations, budget items. So I was sort of questioning if the committee was really providing a lot of value. So we decided that we would continue with the committee for one more year, and if we still felt the same at this point in time next year, then the recommendation may be to disband. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Morton.
The other idea that we had is that we would invite a facilitator along to the first meeting early next year, and hopefully we could draw out some more ideas and maybe more of a strategic focus. So we will be doing that as well. We've had a recommendation from the general manager for a facilitator, but in terms of the nominations, I endorse all of those people. I think it's also safe to say that there wasn't a lot of interest this year from the community. We only had 6 nominations, and they were all from existing committee members. 2 of the committee members didn't actually reapply, and we had no new nominations from anyone else in the community. So, this we'll see how this sort of runs and plays out in the next year. I'm happy to endorse these nominations, and we'll let you know how we go. Also, the other thing I wanted to say is if any staff or councillors had some ideas or feedback or anything like that, I'd be really happy to take that on as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Councillor Gladright. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. And I'll speak a little bit about some maybe thoughts that I've had about the committee, if that's okay. Just noting, and actually I did bring Councillor Bain, so Glenorchy City Council has a Safer Communities Framework. And I guess one of the things that I've really found that is moving the Kingborough Bicycle Advisory Committee along is having that strategy, and actually having the strategy embedded as part of our agenda. And we've got a focus and something to work upon, and something as well that I've heard from people who are setting up the grant process for active transport things, and in their selection criteria is actually do they have a strategy? So therefore that's a tick box. And so in regards to comparing that to other applications, Kingborough Council has a strategy, so we can tick a box. So therefore where we are succeeding in getting quite a lot of grant funding, as well as the excellent applications, but that definitely gives us a priority. So I guess one thing, perhaps a suggestion or thoughts moving forward, is to maybe do a bit of a scope in regards to what other councils are doing in regards to their safety committees, because I know the City of Hobart had a very multicultural focus on their safety committee, and this, when I've read the agenda, the minutes and things, it seems to be very road kind of focus. And then even at the Kingborough Bicycle Advisory Committee, we raise loads of safety matters. Councillor Bain, it's been great that he's been attending. He'll probably, agree with that there's a lot of safety issues in regards to cycling. So I know that you go, oh, not another strategy, not another consultation, but I guess maybe as a moving forward, doing a scope, what other councils are doing around their safety committees or how they're focusing on safety. Glenorchy Council, I think, actually has a safety officer with a focus there. They've done things as well, like even just getting to know your neighbours, doing activities around that so people actually feel safe in their kind of neighbourhoods. And then I guess maybe out of that scoping, you can look at doing a framework or a strategy or something like that. And again, it is that, it's a lot of work, but it does give a kind of framework and a focus, because even the multicultural plan, the LGBTIQA plan. I'm sure all of those strategies raise some sort of safety things as well, so maybe it's pulling together. But anyway, there's my two bobs. And yeah, it is, and just noting as well, people putting their hands up to things, like more and more I'm seeing that the volunteers, you know, we're in a financial crisis. People are working so hard to pay off mortgages and the cost of living and things. So we're seeing less people put their hands up for volunteering as well. So that's just something, I guess, to keep in mind in regards to that.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. I think next
I want to also say thanks to the councillors who were involved and the staff as well, because it's great that it's been ticking along.
Thank you. Councillor Fox and then Councillor Antoli.
I guess I'm just considering the fact that the community representation on this committee includes somebody from the Disability Access Committee and also the Bike Committee. So, in fact, we have less community representation than it appears on this document. And I'm concerned that we're going to stagger on till the end of 2024, and perhaps we should make an earlier assessment, if it's at all possible, before the end of this financial year, for example.
So. Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you, Councillor Gladewright, for, you know, that continuous improvement mindset where, look, if it's not fitting in, if it's not fit for purpose, we either modify or we disband, because the community does not want an inefficient committee doing work that's not, I suppose, impacting. I think Councillor Midgley's ideas seem pretty good. I don't actually have any ideas per se, but I just wanted to thank the six people that have put themselves forward from the community. Some of them I know, some of them I don't know. There would be no reason for me to say no to any of them. But I do appreciate the fact that these people, like Dr. Don Hempton, I know Don. He's a guy that wants to have an effect. That he's the sort of person you'd want on the committee to sort of look at itself and say, are we doing work or not? And if we're not doing work, what can we do and how can we do it better? So, look, I just commend you guys to give it 12 more months, and but I wish I had some better ideas than what Councillor Midgley brought up.
Thank you very much. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I think this is a good, it's a good initiative, and first and most importantly, I really do want to thank the people who have been involved in this committee, including the councillors and the staff, but of course really at the centre of this is community members who care deeply and are passionate about their community and want to give back, and I think that is something that's so admirable, and I and many others are very, very grateful for the effort and the time that people have dedicated to this. I think importantly next time, this is reflective of the fact that there aren't that many people applying, but it's really important that when we do have committees like this that they are broadly representative, not necessarily location by location, but certainly the urban and rural divide. We need to have people with a range of experiences, life experiences, and from a range of different backgrounds. You know, it's worth noting that currently it's really hard when you've got Bruny Island and people travelling over. You know, do you have hybrid meetings or remote meetings to make it easier for people to participate from Bruny? Or indeed just some of the growing areas like Margate that really do need representation when it comes to not just this committee but elsewhere throughout the community. I wanted to talk broadly about what community safety is, because I think that's been potentially one of the tripping points if we have too narrow a focus. And ultimately, a safe community is a livable one where people can go about their daily activities without fear of injury or harm or without fear, really. And there's been a whole lot of work around what it means to have community safety at a local government level. The Pan-Pacific Community Safety Network is just one example, but across Victoria, I know that cities like Geelong and elsewhere have spent a lot of time, I guess, unpacking what community safety means. It isn't as simple as, I think a lot of it has to do with perception and also the thriving of the community, that when you have a community that is full of people who have lots of things to do and they feel included and they feel valued and they're not suffering from harm and deprivation in their own personal and family lives due to macroeconomic circumstances or you know, it's more than just police and streetlights, I guess, is the point that I'm trying to make. So we do need to look at this very holistically. I think it's really good that we're having a period of introspection now. I actually don't have a strong opinion on whether it should be 12 months or less, but I just think this is a really great opportunity to reassess and re-strategise and really set forward a plan about what the value add is for the community. So once again, I thank everybody for their involvement and I really look forward to the next steps. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. Just quickly, just like to thank the six people who have reapplied, and I agree with pretty much everything that's been said around the table. It's an opportunity for a reset, look at a broader scope, and as Councillor Midgley said, look at what some other organisations are doing, get some ideas from that, and hopefully get some improved outcomes over the next 12 months. So I think it is worthwhile pursuing for 12 months and seeing if we can make some improvements. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Bain. Councillor Dean.
Just a quick question. Have the other committees that we have undertaken the same process in terms of internal review?
Sorry, that was so quiet. I couldn't hear anything you said.
Have the other committees that we have, in terms of the Cycling Committee and the Disability Advisory Access Committee, have undertaken the same review process?
Not recently. Certainly, as Councillor Midgley indicated, that the Bicycle Advisory Committee has a strategy, so they have a document that they're working towards they're very practical in terms of their outcomes. And in terms of the Disability Inclusion Access Advisory Committee, we're part responsive to development applications that come before us. So, for example, during the development of Kingston Park and the hub, we had numerous engagements with the staff who were working on the plans, and we went over and tested things for their suitability and so on, but we also then work on projects. So unfortunately at our last meeting last week we didn't get a quorum, but we would have set our work plan for the following year. So we tend to work like that towards a plan, because we already have an inclusion policy that we review and a strategy. But I think one of the things that's been really interesting is that when I first took over the chair of the Disability Committee about 8 years ago or so, we had declining levels of interest within the community, and now we have so many people applying that we almost can't take everybody because the meetings would become too unwieldy. So there's been I think with the NDIS coming on board and so on, there's been a resurgence of interest, which has been terrific. And, they're a very active and engaged committee, so I wouldn't feel the need to for us to sit around and navel gaze for that committee. We'll just get on and, in the new year, work out our work plan for the year. But I do think that the safety committee, having had some involvement over the last couple of years since it was formed, I know they have sort of struggled. And it was an amalgamation. We used to have two committees. So it was the Road Safety Committee and the Community Safety Committee that then amalgamated into the one. And previously I sat on both of those committees, and they kind of just sort of very similar to what Councillor Gladright has described, where they started to become very focused on service requests and the same issues sort of over and over again. And so we thought that by joining the two together, there might be a bigger strategic opportunity there. I think one of the things that has been tremendous about it is that since we have Inspector Riley over at Kingston Police, he's been very engaged with the Safety Committee, which has been really valuable. And he's been a great resource for us here with getting our CCTV cameras operational and all that sort of thing. So, you know, he would be somebody I think that would be worth engaging in with us. He will be as part of the workshop. So, yeah, I think it's good that the committee is sort of looking at considering what they might do in the future.
That's great. All I'd just say is I'd be open to the idea of a bit more of a wider review of the communities that we do have and looking at whether there's actually other avenues, whether we merge or whatever it is that we do, just a wider review. So, because I think it's a really bold step from the safety community to actually fess up and kind of say, hey, maybe this isn't the best use of council resources and people's time. So in a year's time, I'd like to, yeah, potentially have a bit of a wider view. But in the meantime, I think it's really great.
Thank you. Councillor Fox, with a question?
I have a question. When the original committee was set up, it was basically an initiative of the state government, and we had a Department of State Roads officer attending those meetings, as well as an RACT representative that was really helpful for communicating issues around the state, and they could then promote them in their magazine, etc. Have these people been considered as being re-invited? That's my question.
Councillor Gladwright.
No, they haven't, but yeah, they're all fantastic suggestions and making lots of mental notes. So thank you.
I think one of the issues when I did chair the Road Safety Committee is that we just couldn't get nominations from those organisations any longer. So I know that I think I saw somebody from RACT once in a couple of years that I was deputy chair of Road Safety Committee. So there was just, everybody's so busy that there was just, it was difficult to get nominations from some of those organisations, unfortunately. Is there any further discussion on this? Councillor Gladwright, did you want to sum up?
No, just to thank everyone for their suggestions, and if people think of other things, feel free to email me.
Thank you very much. I'm going to put the recommendation as printed on the screen, so that's the one with the names that have been inserted into the recommendation. Moved by Councillor Gladwright, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Turn now to page 52, audit panel appointment, with a recommendation on page 53. Looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Move Councillor Fox, seconded Councillor Gladwright. Councillor Fox.
Yes, I have worked with this Ms. Colette Miller, and she's an excellent audit panel representative, and I think she would be, if she's willing to be reappointed, I think we should reappoint her. I think it would be very wise. Thank you
very much. Any further comments, questions? If not, I will put the recommendation. Moved by Councillor Fox, seconded by Councillor Gladwright. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried. Takes us to page 54, financial report for November 2023, with a recommendation on page 56. Looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved Councillor Bain, seconded Councillor Midgley. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. So the financial report for November 2023, the forecast result for 23-24 is now an underlying deficit of $978,000, which has increased from $688,000 at the end of October. The main reasons for the increase in the forecast deficit is due to the number of planning applications and supplementary property rates we're receiving dropping. Both of these reductions have been noted in previous reports, so not a surprise. However, we're now seeing the end-of-year forecast deficit adjusted to reflect those reductions. So I'm happy to endorse the report.
Thank you, Councillor Bain. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a couple of questions around. Firstly, it's clear that the impact on depreciation and the reason why it's so over budget is due to those assets being revalued. So, for example, stormwater assets were revalued, resulting in a 50% increase in value and indexation over other infrastructure assets. This will happen again next year, and I'm just wondering to what extent will it impact us when it flows through into next year?
Mr. Spinks.
Through you, Mayor. Yes, it will, because every time we revalue an asset class, typically valuations go up, so therefore the depreciation expense goes up. What we want to do this year, though, and I think this has been normal practice, I think this one's just been an aberration, is we want to have the revaluation sort of done fairly soon so we know the depreciation impact, so therefore it can be factored into the budget rather than what's happened this year is the budget was set and then we got the results of the reval. So fingers crossed that'll be the case. But to answer your question, yes, we're in this ongoing cycle of revaluing our assets, which we need to do. And in the absence of extending asset lives, it means that depreciation expense goes up.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Just another question. That's very helpful. Thank you. The other question is, in the dot point on, it's about halfway of page 55, it says, other income is $117,000 over budget, primarily due to private works revenue, which is the recovery of incurred expenditure. I wonder if you could please just elaborate on that, kind of unpack what that means for me.
Mr. Spinks.
Yep, happy to do so, Mayor. I can't give you examples of what it involves, but certainly this is private works which is done by council, so we obviously charge for those works having been undertaken, so it's an expense to us but also an income item, so they tend to sort of net off or very close to.
Thank you. And then my final question is just about, it's broadly about headworks charges really, but my interest was piqued in the mention there of a once-off fee for a subdivision. And when we do get big subdivisions coming through, are we actually monitoring not just the price that they pay in once-off fees for subdivisions, but the impact on council's overall budget? And so take, for example, a large subdivision, whether it's Whitewater or Spring Farm or Huntingfield, the council gets some money for that in the initial phase, and then council also will get the benefit of having, you know, 400 or 600 new ratepayers or whatever it might be. But are we keeping track of, over the course of a certain period of time, are we ahead or are we behind? As in, does it cost more to add in these new subdivisions than we get back in return? Has some analysis of that been done, and is that analysis ongoing? Do we do it each time we sign off on a new subdivision of a large scale, not just small ones?
Mr. Spinks.
Mayor, look, I'm not aware that we do it sort of to that level of detail. Certainly you're quite right that we generate additional rates income from these subdivisions, but we also incur additional costs from waste collection and maintenance and all these other things, street lighting and what have you. I don't think we've ever sort of sat down and tried to work out for each subdivision whether we're winning or losing, if I can put it that way. But certainly, we, as budgets roll forward, we're budgeting for that additional rates income, and we're also budgeting for the additional costs from those subdivisions, for sure.
Yeah. The General Manager would just like to add something to that.
Through you, Mayor, my colleague Mr. Spinks wouldn't be aware of this, but with his predecessor we did some financial modelling a couple of years ago, and I presented that modelling to the State Grants Commission. It was based on the Spring Farm estate, and what the financial modelling showed us was that there's effectively a two-year lag for a big subdivision before we reach break-even, given that we take over or inherit the assets that the developers put in terms of infrastructure, roads, footpaths, etc. But once you get past that first two years with a big subdivision, then you start as a council to reap the benefit of the extra rate revenue. That's not necessarily the case with many of the small subdivisions we get, which might be one or two lots. But that work has been done and presented to the State Grants Commission. But again, to pick up the other part of your question, it hasn't been something that we've been doing on an ongoing basis, but I'm sure Mr. Spinks will take that on board.
Thank you so much. That's really helpful. Just to conclude my remarks, Mayor, the main reason why I'm interested in it is obviously doing back-of-the-envelope figures where we say, OK, there's 400 new houses, maybe we'll get $400,000 a year in rates from that, and that's a good thing. But then if we see in our budget, okay, well, we're now investing $650,000 in stormwater and $1.1 million for a footpath here and all those other community expectations, you know, as well the community should have those expectations for our service delivery. But I do think it will really help us make decisions as a council as to whether or not we should implement further headworks charges or try and recoup those costs more and more, because in the context of us being one of the fastest growing populations in the whole state, there will come a time where the premium that we have to offer, the value that we have to offer, because we're so close to the capital city, because we have such great natural and cultural assets, people will want to continue developing in our region, and we need to make an assessment as to whether we can continue to do that at the current price point that we're setting. I'm quietly confident that people do want to continue to move into Kingborough and develop in Kingborough, both residentially and commercially, because of the great opportunities that we have here, but we just need to make sure that we're setting those developments at a price point that properly reflects the amount of investment that council has to make so that we get the adequate return on investment and are able then to give that to the community back through excellent service delivery. So I hope we stay focused on that as we go into the future. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Further comments? Councillor Gladright.
Yeah, thank you. I just had a question on page 62 regarding the public open space funds. There were some funny contributions there by Jill Mannering. Can anybody explain those to me, please?
Mr. Spinks?
Unless any of my colleagues can help me out, Mayor, I might have to take that one on notice.
Okay. Thank you. Anything further, Councillor Gladrott? Thank you. Further comments, discussions? Councillor Bain, did you want to sum up? I'm going to put the recommendation moved by Councillor Bain, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Takes us to page 77, appendices, with a recommendation on the same page. Looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved Councillor Cordova, seconded Councillor Midgley. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. I just had one question, Mayor, if I may, about the audit minutes. And it says somewhere in the audit minutes, I'm just trying to find it, that it's page 85, it says, under insurance matters, emerging risks and legal claims, quote, the manager finance updated the panel on the issue of the sovereign citizen challenge, end quote. Mm-hmm. So please may we have some further information about that challenge. What does it mean for council? What are the impacts and how widespread is the sovereign citizen challenge?
Mr. Spinks, I think we might have had this listed in closed session that we've previously in closed session on compliance matters, have we? Or is it okay to talk about in open session? It's fine? Okay. Mr. Spinks.
I'll do my best, Mayor, to respond to this. Look, in essence, it's people who are claiming to be sovereign citizens and therefore challenge council's right to levy rates and so on and so forth. So that issue has been gaining somewhat. We have some at this council who are claiming that, but it's also a circumstance which is sort of gaining a little more prevalence around the nation. So it brings with it some challenges.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. So I guess to understand the full quantum of that, maybe I'll just reserve a question maybe for closed council about that.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Any further discussions? I'm going to put the motion then. Moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. Notice the motion. There were none. We now come to confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. I've got a mover in Councillor Gladright, seconder in Councillor Fox. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried. So that brings us to the end of closed session, and in accordance with our meetings audio recording guidelines policy, recording of the open session of the meeting will now cease very shortly. But before that, I just wanted to, given that we're about to go into the Christmas break, thank all of our staff here at Council for the work that they have put in throughout the year, and thank councillors who have also worked exceptionally hard during this year, and convey on behalf of Council to all members of our community a very happy, healthy and safe Christmas and New Year. So thank you for being with us this evening, and the open session of Council will now adjourn at 8:19 p.m.